Okay, let's open up the Megillah, Esther. But I want to actually do something that might be, for the first time in our lives, for some of us perhaps, to actually open up Megillah, Esther, certainly the first time in many years, to open Megillah, Esther, and actually learn Megillah, Esther with open eyes.
Shnayim Mikra
Megillas
Esther.
Shnayim Mikra Megillas Esther. Yeah, sort of. We've spoken many times over the course of the year about the Tzitzis party and how some of the things that have come across earliest tend to, if we can proceed through life with inertia, we will sort of stick with our childish understandings, which were age appropriate the first time we met that concept. But as you grow, your understanding of the concept of Yadus needs to grow with you also. And I think Purim in general and Megillas Esther in particular certainly are prime on that list. Because when you're little, so you get a child's understanding of Megillas Esther, that makes a lot of sense. But how often do we actually open up the Pesukim beyond that point? We listen to Megillas Esther, listen to every word, but to actually analyze. The Malbim... The Malbim did exactly that. The Malbim's whole approach to Tanakh in general is to learn Pshat Ruach Hazal, to actually learn through the Pesukim carefully, and to focus on Pshat, not on Drash, but to focus on Pshat in the spirit of Chazal. And he often has very, very creative ideas, very new and fresh ideas. The Mamash come from reading the Pesukim. And that's throughout Tanakh, but Megillas Esther in particular. Because I think Esther and Shir HaShirim probably is a greater contribution in terms of basic understanding made by the Malbim than perhaps any other Svarim of Nevi'im or Ketuvim. So hopefully before Pesach we'll have a chance to open up a Shir HaShirim with the Malbim. I want to take the chance now. Today we're starting with a small chevra, so to leverage our opportunity to open up the Megillah. So, a couple of basic questions. And what I'd love to do now, by the way, in particular, after we sort of get our warm up and get our minds working about the Megillah in general, to look at the first parak of Megillas Esther in particular. Because when we think about the story of the Megillah, Just to sort of get ourselves warmed up in general, in terms of like psukim and pieces of the Megillah that we often sort of let slide, turn for a moment one or two things. Number one, beginning of Parag Gimel. Achar ha-dvarim ha-eila gida ha-melech ha-chashverosh is Haman, right? All of a sudden, Paragil were introduced to Haman for the first time, at least Haman under the name Haman. And all of a sudden, he's meteoric rise to power. Why? What clues does the Megillah itself give us in terms of why? Achar Dvar Me'ela. It sounds like, Prashim Shad, it's coming on the heels and a result of something that happened before. What happened before is Big Sin Zeresh. How did that happen? So how did one lead to the other? And later on, we hear about Bigson and Seresh again. Achashverosh seems incredibly upset when he learns that Bigson, that Mordechai and Esther were never, or Mordechai was never rewarded. Why is he so upset? And why is it so surprising? And why is it that in one place it's written it's a sefer divrei hayamim, and later on it's a sefer as the chronos? Different terminology. What's going on? And why is it that Achashverosh's anger gets poured out on Haman over the fact that Mordechai was never rewarded? Is it just the fact that now Haman happens to want to get Mordechai for something else, or is there something more at work? That's one set of sort of questions. The whole Bigson and Seresh. What that subplot that plays out in very important but subtle ways. Another thing that's strange, I don't want to answer that just yet, That's something that we're going to, as we progress to the Nevilah, not today, we have to come back to. Another thing that's strange is here's a, you look at when they send out the letters. Right? They're sending a lot of correspondence, a lot of mail going on, not email, but once upon a time, letters were actually written on a physical background, with physical ink, and transported by people in mail, physical mail bags to other locations where they'll be opened and read. Right? So you have a lot of that in the Megillah, probably more than most Sifrei Tanakh. In the Megillah, there's discussion, description, sending mail, written correspondence. That's part of how you run a bureaucracy. Right? And Esther is about politics and bureaucracy. You don't run 127 province empire without a fair amount of a hopefully efficient bureaucracy. And we get a I'm going to say, think about it in the Megillah terms. That's what it is. You're seeing a national government, you're seeing a federation perhaps, and you're seeing the way a bureaucracy is run. But take a look, please. Here. Perek Gimel Pasuk Yud Beis. Let's read just some sukkim together. Perek Gimel Pasuk Yud Beis. On the 13th of Nisan, we would call 2 days before Pesach, they gather all the Sofrei HaMelech, and they start writing letters. They write down the they take dictation from Haman. What are we writing to all the leaders? And it's signed and it's sealed. Pasuk Gimel says now it's sent. V'nishloach Sfarim B'yana Ratzim. Is sent out, Lahashmid, Larov, Lahabed, etc. Psukim, Paragimel, Psukim, Beis, and Gimel seem to give a thorough description of the writing, sealing, the signing, sealing, and sending of these letters. Right? Sounds like we're done. Pasuk Yudalid, Pashegen, Haksav, Lina, Sein, Das, Bechal, Medina, Medina. The Pashegen of the writing is there should be rules in every Medina, Galui, Lechal, Amim, Lios, Asidim, Lyamas, be ready for that day. What does that mean? I don't know what that means. What does that mean? It's like a totally unnecessary pasuk. Pasuk Yud Beis said they wrote the letters. Pasuk Yud Gimel says they send the letters. Pasuk Tezvav talks about the messengers being rushed out the door. Haratim Yatsu Dechufim, and everyone is Ir Shushan Navocha. So, now what's a Pashegen Aksav all about? What does that mean? Well, what is a Pashegen? And why are we repeating? It's not even a good repeat. Very vague. And it happens again. What's with Pashag and Excel? And one more problem is Vair Shushan Navocha. So your association with Navocha probably means sad. Because when the Baal Kriya lays there, Vair Shushan Navocha, and Echonigan, is, oh, we know it's sad. What does Navocha mean? Right. Mar Navuchim, right? Or Navuchim Heim Babidvar. Howard didn't think that the Jewish people were sad in the Midbar. He just thought they were lost and confused. Mor Nevuchim is not for people who are sad. It's for not for people who just had a loss. It's for people who are confused. So by Yishushan Navocha, why were they confused? They might have been very sad. What was confusing? This is very clear. It's frightening. They can't understand how this happened. It seems like a funny word to use. Right? The very next pasuk says, Mordechai knows what's going on, and he is terribly sad. And he's an avelus, he's tearing his clothing, sakvei for the whole works. Yishushan Navocha? So far, what do we have, Rav Osai? Avelos are just coming on board now. So far, what do we have? Sort of opening what we've done so far, just to open the Megillah, and just to begin to read the Psukim, and notice a whole slew of really strange things. And we just saw two sets of kashas. A first set of kashas about the Big Son and Seresh piece, a second set of kashas about the letters. And again, the Big Son Seresh appears twice, in the Perek Beis, and later on, when Achashverosh can't sleep, that's when it sort of comes back to bite. We can't understand, again, let's just have to recap the questions quickly. We don't understand what's the connection of Big Son and Seresh and Haman's rise to power. It sounds in the Pesukim there's a connection. Achar Dvar Me'el, Pashup Shat, was one through the other. And we can't understand the sort of the intensity of Achashverosh's reaction. When he realizes that Mordechai was never paid back for Big Son Zeresh. It happens to be that Haman is coming to attack Mordechai, but nothing to do with that. And Muhammad had no idea what was going on with Dixon and Sarish. Is Achashverosh beast being irrational? And what's with, is it a safer Dibre Hayamim? Or is it a safer Zichronos?
Why the switch in terminology? So that's one set of questions. The whole Dixon and Sarish subplot, which is very critical to the whole story. Another set of questions is with the letters. What's with this Pascheg and Aksav? And why are the people, why is the city Navocha instead of Navelus as Mordechai?
Okay, let's put aside for now those two sets of questions. Can you hear me? Can you hear me down there? Yeah, we're good? If we could move, we can move. You can hear me? Okay. Now I want to come back. So as I was saying before, what I want to just lay out,
just for us to realize, number one, we need to actually learn the Megillah with open eyes.
And there's a lot going on. Posh trap. We have not necessarily been sensitive to, which hopefully the Malbim will help us to do. And now that we recognize that, and Bli Neder, over the next week, we'll have chances to come back to the Vixen and Sarish piece, and to the letters piece. But right now, I want to turn our attention back, now that our eyes are open, let's come back to the first parak. Mamish, the opening psukim of the Megillah. The psukim that we think we know so well. Right? Here's your simple question. I have a lot of questions. Malbim has a lot of questions in this first parak. Let's start with a simple one.
Who needs the first parak of Megillas Esther?
Remember, first parak of Megillas Esther is this whole story of the party. And parak Beis. So turn to here in most of the Chumash we have is page 243. Right? First parak begins with Achashverosh. Kisema, he has his throne. He's in Shushan, in the palace at Susa, as a historian would tell you in English. And this glorious party, and everyone's invited, and then another party for 7 days for everyone in Shushan, and then in the midst of that, Ketovli Vamav Bayayin Vashti is eliminated. And then they send us some letters about men being in charge. Right? Curtain drops. Parak Beis, now we're looking for. Achashverosh calms down and he says, "Ooh, I got rid of Vashti. I better get myself a new wife." Right,
and that's what gives Esther a foot in the door.
So, who pray tell needs Parak Aleph? Right? Again, we've said in the past, where arguably the most central agadata for us in learning Tanakh methodologically is that Gemara Megillah, the Nevuah Shel Hotzer Chodaros Nichtava, Nevuah Shel Hotzer Chodaros Lo Nichtava. So much the tiny minority of Nevuos made into Tanakh, only those things which have eternal relevance. So we need to know for the rest of the story that Vashti was killed, and that opened up the opportunity for Esther to become queen. Good. That's important. But beyond that, who needs the first parak? Who needs it? Yeah, what do you say? Oh, okay, good. So the Gemara says on Darach Drash that could be the significant. The Gemara presumably is in part bothered by this question: why is this here? So it could be that the Jews were mitzarev to the party, and Al Zed that they were nenshu. And Mordechai told them, "Don't go," and they went, and they're punished for that.
That I believe is the end of the first parak of Megillah.
The end of the first parak of Megillah is Medrash Esther. You have certain different places in Shas where the Gemara switches gears into like a Medrash mode, a Medrash genre. Medrash means you have Tarshu Rapeh organized not topically, but Al Seder HaPsukim.
So you have somewhat in Masechah Sota and elsewhere, but the largest chunk, you have Medrash Shimshon, Masechah Sota.
The biggest chunk, I think, in Shas is the last number of blot of the first parak of Megillah, for those who have learned it.
And the Gemara goes basically Kimat Pasuk by Pasuk through the entire Megillah.
So, but still you wonder, there's so much detail. So tell me that Achashverosh made parties and the Jews went. And the Pesukim don't even say that the Jews went. Ikar Chasam and HaSefer. If that's the only message, that is one of the messages, Al Derech Drash. If that's the only message, then the Pesukim would have said so. And if that's the only message, the only significance for us of the entire Parak Aleph, the whole party of Achashverosh, the Jews went, they shouldn't have gone. Not only Ikar Chasam and HaSefer doesn't say that the Jews are there, but also, you don't need so much detail. You say that Achashverosh made a big party and the Jews went starve. Terrible. Look at how it's described. Take a look at Pasuk Dalet. the haroso is osher kavod malchuso. He's showing off how incredibly, obscenely wealthy he was. Yikar teferes gedulasa. He's just showing off how great he is. 180 days. And pasuk vav, the chur karpos was chelus. If you go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, you can see ritzbas bat. You can see what an alabaster floor looks like. And if you go to the Metro, if you're not a Kohen, you go to the Met. I used to go to the Met. I went a number of times. I actually went a number of times with, once or twice, with Rabbi Yehuda Landi, who is, I think I may have mentioned him to you in the past, is a remarkable, remarkable Talmud Chacham, a Baki and Bavli Rishalmi, and he's a self-taught archaeologist. He's an autodidact. He never, as far as I know, he has no college education. And he's on, I'm not sure he's on first name basis, but he's certainly on close speaking terms with the directors and the curators of a number of museums around the world. And he has a personal connection with the people who run the Met, the British Museum, and the museum in Berlin. And he's gotten permission from them to, you know, to take pictures and publish them in his, he put out a Megillas Esther with the archaeological perspective with Yirat Shamayim, which is a very rare combination. So he does, professionally, he does tours, among other things. He'll do Tanakh tours, the Tanakh-themed tours of Eretz Yisrael. He also has Tanakh-themed tours of the British Museum and the Met. And I went with him once or twice, actually went with the Shir in years past, until I took my kids once or twice after that and showed them what he had showed us. It's amazing, he takes you from Avram Avinu to Esther in the Met. Because there's an ancient Near East collection, there's an Egyptian collection. And then one time I was there and I discovered in the Egyptian collection that there is a sarcophagus that seems to actually have a mummy in it. So my boys and I made a very quick exit out of the museum because we are Kohen. But you can see there, he'll show you. And after he shows you, not only says you see that white slab, it's like a tile like this big, like 2-3 feet square, that's Bahat. Ritzpas Bahat. An alabaster floor, it's gorgeous, and that's one tile. And then he shows you that they did excavations at Persepolis, which was the other palace, the companion to Susa, to Shushan. And they even have, you get a sense of the size, it's overwhelming. It's overwhelming how enormous it was. Huge! You think, you come into the... You come, they've done these excavations. You imagine what it was like to walk, for Esther to walk into the thing, you walk into the king's throne room, the younger the Shavuot of your dead. It was overwhelming the way, and it wasn't just Achashverosh. That's why Sancheir, they have a mock up of Sancheir's palace. It was built to be frightening. Like 20, 30, 40 feet tall, the pillars, and the frightening pillars with these like animal heads on animal heads are like larger than you are. It's overwhelming. And the wealth that's being described here is staggering. As a matter of fact, you can even see, I wish I had a picture here to show you. They have a golden rhyton, R-H-Y-T-O-N, a golden drinking cup. But not just a drinking cup. I'm not sure if it's solid gold or alloyed, but it's not gold plated. It's around yay big with like a sculpture of an animal, like a fanciful sculpture of an animal as a handle. And on the caption in the museum, the Met, next to that cup, it says that this is from Susa. So he points out that cup, that actual cup in the museum, was probably used at this party of Achashverosh. That's one of the cups. The Kalim, the Klei Zahav, the Kalim, Shonim. Okay, I'm sure the Gemara says maybe a reference particularly to Beis HaMikdash, but so that's not all they were using. That cup, you can see a cup, you can be 2 feet, you can't touch it because it's buying glass, but you can be 2 feet, if you go to the Met, you can be 2 feet away from a cup that your great grandfather might have drunken from at the Mishta of Achashverosh. Okay. Mamash makes it very, very real and tangible. But it's fascinating, beautiful. But Lamaisa, it's all very nice. Why isn't Tanakh? If you write a history, this is fascinating stuff. But why does the Tanakh need to tell us all the money and all the stuff and on the invitation list? Who cares? Tell me, there was a big party. Achashverosh got drunk. the Jewish people came, they got drunk too. When he was drunk, he acted like a real fool, and they got rid of his wife. Later on, he regrets it, and now he needs a new wife, and Mimela in walks Esther. Who needs more than that? There's a lot of psukim. 22 psukim in the first parak. Why? Why? You know, you might know, that the Tanaim have a machlokas in Masechta Megillah. Where do you start Mikra Megillah from? Many Tanaim held you don't start from the beginning. At different points in Megillah. Maybe the mitzvah of Mikra Megillah is not the whole Megillah. Right? When you read the Parshas Parah, you don't read all the Chumash Bamidbar, you just read Parshas Parah. So who says you have to read all? You're laying every week. You don't lay in the whole Chumash every week. You're laying one piece. So then Tanaim had a machlokas. You have to read the whole Megillah of Esther. Very long. We pass and yes. They're pointing to the fact that not all parts of Megillah are equally central to the story. But then, Mikra Zomer Darshani, what's Takap Shah? Why is it here? The Malbim says, that's a big question. He says, if you look at the Psukim one by one and ask some more specific questions, it's going to change everything. Please, every single person here, take a look. Inside, a Perek Aleph, Pasuk Gimel. Perek Aleph, Pasuk Gimel. Take a couple of moments to take a look at that Pasuk and tell me what's surprising about that Pasuk. But first, before you get to the Kashas, what would we call in our terminology? That pasuk in English has a two-word name for that pasuk. Everyone who makes a simcha needs to do this. We call it a what? Huh? No. But pasuk gimel. If you make a bar mitzvah, you make a wedding, even a bris. Bris, we don't call it that exactly, but otherwise that's what it is. You have to have an invitation list, right? Pasuk Gimel is an invitation list, right? You make it a simcha. Sometimes people spend hours and hours and hours trying to make sure you get everyone you need to have. B'didan ha'va'uvda. There was someone who was moser nefesh to come to the bris of our oldest. And when we sent out notices about the bris of our second son, we forgot to notify him. We felt terrible afterwards. So ever since, I was very careful. Right? You always want to make sure you don't leave out someone that... Yeah, you know, totally b'shogeg. I want to include him. I didn't include him. People, you know, it means a lot to people. So this is the invite list. This is a royal invite list. And when things are handled in diplomatic in state circles, this is going to be thought about very carefully. So this is the invite list. Who's on the invite list to the party? The avadim, the sarim, his avadim, chel parasum partimim, the soldiers. And who's last on the invite list? You guys see here? Who's last on the invite list? Who's last on the invite list? Sari Hamedinos. So I think the chaver's coming in. So this is this invitation list. At first you wonder, who needs an invitation list? But then you notice... The Malbim points out the invitation list is backwards. You invite the governors of provinces, the senators, they're last on the list. They come after the soldiers. Good morning. What the ultimate violation of royal protocol? What's going on? And B'chalal, the Megillah stresses so much the overwhelming wealth that he's using. Crazy, 180 days, Baharo, and it's clear. It's not just that Achashverosh was a fool who didn't know how to budget his money, or that he was just a hedonistic first individual who just like lost all control, had no sense of limits. Miguel makes it clear. Mal points out that Achashverosh is doing this deliberately. Baharo says not just that he spent loads of money. This was an attempt to demonstrate the extent of his wealth. Bahar Oso in Pasuk Dalet is Osher Kavod Malchuso. He wants to demonstrate the incredible wealth of his malchus. And Yikar Tif Eretz Gedulos, so not just his wealth, but his glory. What's going on? What's going on with the money? What's going on with the deliberate plan? What's going on with the stress right away of the Kisei HaMalchus, its position in a particular place, the invitation list, and then the Pesukim can go on to talk about, again, in Pasuk Vav and on about how much he spent and the Klei Zahav. And two more things. Malm points out in Psukim Hey and Ches, there's a stress on the root. Take a look at Pasuk Ches. Hashtia Kadas Einones. Right? We know the Gemara's interpretation, what that means in terms of how they drank and what they gave them to drink. But they had freedom. Ein Ones. They had a lot of flexibility in terms of how they drank. Kichen Yisad Hamel. That was the rule the king had made. Pray tell. Why is that not bothered to tell us? But more so, why is the king making drinking rules? It sounds like these weren't the previous drinking rules. He created new drinking rules for this party. And the drinking rule that the king had made up for this party is you have more flexibility, apparently, than you normally would have. Right? And then go back to Pasuk Hey. Vimlos Hayam Ha'ele, at the part, this beginning of party number two. Koham Anim Zibushushan Habir Lamiga Davi Akatan. A stress again and again. Paragal Pasuk Hey, that every single person is invited. Lamiga Davi Akatan. It doesn't matter, in other words, what your social status is. Every single person in Shushan Bar None is invited to the palace for party number two. And the Tukim stick in where it was. The Chatzar Ginas Bisan Hamel. That he was on royal territory. That he was on royal territory. Why the stress on where it was? And why the stress on stressing again and again? Everyone is in Shushan, everyone Nigadov Akatan. Says the Malbim, you know what's going on here? It's Gevalt. I'll tell you what's going on here. What's Achashverosh's plan? What's Achashverosh's game? What's his objective? Malum says, you know what you see? Achashverosh wants to accomplish a political goal. Well, let's think about this. He's trying to show off how much money he has, and his money wants to show off how much power he has. He invites the governors, but only after the simplest people who work for him personally. And then he turns around and invites every single person who lives in Shushan without regard to social standing into Chatzar Ginas Bisamelch, into what sounds like is probably normally unauthorized, a space where they would not be authorized to go. And he makes new rules that everyone has more freedom in terms of drinking than they used to have. Says the Malbim, you know what picture you get? The picture you get is that Achashverosh is trying to redefine the terms of his leadership. You get the sense that to use it, again, these terms are anachronistic. We use terms that are more modern. But in Persian terms, Achashverosh is trying to shift, as Malcolm suggests, from being a constitutional monarch to being an absolute monarch. And Achashverosh is trying to show that it's not that he's a king who, yes, has power, but operates within together with other parts of the government. He's trying to redefine himself as, I am totally in control. Which is why, number one, the invite list, he'll invite the senators and the governors, but they come after the Pshutei Am. Anyone who works for me personally, my soldiers, get more covet than anyone who thinks that they could be a check on my power. And he suggests the obscene, disproportionate expenditure, as though it's my own money to spend as I see fit, and not that it's the money of the state that I have the right to, that I'm a trustee of. It's my personal fund. I'll do whatever I want. And that's Bahar Oso's Oshak Fod Malchuso. My Malchus. It's the money of mine. And Yikar Tiferes Geduloso. It's a deliberate attempt to show my Gedula. I'm totally in charge. I can spend money in the most ridiculous, absurd way. 180 days of partying? That's absurd. That's totally exaggerated. That was exactly how Achashverosh's plan. There was nothing foolish about it. It was a carefully laid approach to tighten his grip on power.
And that's the invite list. And that's Dafka bringing in the Pshutayam. Because if I'm totally in control, I could change all the rules, I could change all the traditions of Persian propriety. I'm in charge. I'm not bound by any rules. I can let the Hoy Poloi into the Chatzar Ginas B'Zonamel. I can make new rules about Eino Neis. There will no longer be protocol, but the strict protocol in terms of who drinks and how much. No, I'm in charge. It cuts both ways. I'm going to reduce the power of the governors. I'll give more freedom to everyone because everyone is equally subservient to me. That's Achashverosh's game. That's what the Malbim suggests. Read the opening psukim, the first parsha, the first paragraph up until the Samach. Carefully, first eight psukim, it's Achashverosh's careful, deliberate plan to gain power. Questions? Why is that? Why is that? Oh, so who cares? Who cares? So number one, we begin to see, that's a great question. So number one, Mal points out, the next paragraph, beginning with the Pasuk Tes, the next parasha, Vashti Amalka sounds like she's making a counter move. Because remember, the Gemara tells us that the Achashverosh has really gotten to the Malchus through marriage to Vashti. So she's not going to let this just sort of slide. No way. No way. So she makes her own party, and then the politicking goes on. But I would say, Rabosai, the largest answer to Elazar's question, I think, brings us to a very important insight. The Malbim, I don't think he makes the following point, but I would suggest, based on what the Malbim is saying, if you take a step back, it could be that besides the fact that parts of Parag Aleph are important in terms of setting us up for the story to come, we could learn Parag Aleph on its own. I think Parak Aleph stands on its own as an incredible Musar profile. Because consider what you have. Achashverosh is trying to do what? He's pulling out all the stops to achieve total power and total control. Everything he's doing, this carefully laid plan for political advancement. And yet, when you come to the end of the paragraph, you take a step back, who has the least control and power? Achashverosh. Everyone is pulling the strings. Everyone is yanking his chain. Right? Vashti upends his plans. Memuchan, who Chazal suggests may be Haman. Look what happens. He wakes up the next time, like, you know, paraphrase. Wakes the next morning and says, Gewalt, I just killed my wife. What did I do? The most absurd thing. I sent out the most ridiculous sounding letter. Ah, I sent out a royal edict that the men are in charge, and that royal edict about the language that should be spoken in a bilingual home. Really? That's worthy of a royal edict? Sounds like a fool. He got rid of his wife in his drunken stupor. But in his drunken state, he got rid of his wife. He did the most absurd things. He had less power than anyone else. That's the irony. And he thinks, Mensch tracht und Weg läuft. Achashverosh thinks that he's going to consolidate power. He's going to walk out of this half a year of parties. Boom, total control. And when it's all over, Vashti played games with him. Memuchan played games with him. He really ends up being the least powerful of all. One could understand, given the Malbim's view on the first parak, again, that Achashverosh is attempting to consolidate power, and that's the goal here. You could read it Miguel Derek Remes. And you think about every person, and sort of like I almost like as a metaphor for every person's struggle with his own Yetzer Hara. And sometimes as our gaiva leads us astray, and we think we're accomplishing great things, when in fact in the Yetzer Hara is playing games with us. And look at Achashverosh as a person's will. And Memuchan as a person's Yetzer Hara. It leads us into foolish decisions. But even without reading it Al-Derech Remez, or that's the way the Vilna Gaon famously reads Yonah that way. It's Yonah, Al-Derech Remez, as a metaphor for internal struggles of a human being to do the right thing and not do the wrong thing. And all the different characters in Yonah, Al-Derech Remez, are sort of different parts of a person's psyche.
That's not Pirush HaMikra, but sort of an additional level of that rabbi.
You could certainly read the first part of HaMikra like that, but even Al Pi Pshuto, it's talking about Achashverosh. But it's a profile, it stands on its own, sort of like as a profile of what Gaiva could do to a person. He's so blinded by his Gaiva that he thinks that he's getting it all and he's really missing the boat. So like a, almost like the first paragraph stands as always like as a reminder to not get lost, not get morally lost. Remember what happened after Rish. He thought he was just amassing more and more power. He ends up with pie in his face. He would have been an Anav. He would have been far more successful. And he would have walked out far happier. That's Perek Aleph on its own. Gevalt. That's Perek Aleph on its own. I'd love to take questions. And then a different time, maybe next week, we're going to go back. We're intentionally leaving hanging questions. This is just the first parak. Already, I hope, has been transformed in our eyes. Just reading the first couple of psukim that's so familiar. All of a sudden, just reading the psukim carefully takes on a totally different picture. So we're going to see going forward, he's going to, Malbin's going to give us a transplant of insight to Pshuto Shel Mikra of the story. Big Son and Seresh and the letters, there's so much going on. Whole parts of the plot that he's going to unfold before our eyes. Questions?
Yeah. If this is a power play by Ahasuerus and Vashti making her party as a counterplay, and by her refusing to come, she's basically saying that you're not winning, then he's making a calculated decision by killing her. So why is he so regretful?
Yeah, why is he regretting? That's a good question. So the truth is, you could read, the truth is, the Malbim suggests in Perek Beis Pasuk Aleph, he remembers Vashti, he remembers what she did, and that's why they now take a different approach to wife getting. Malbim suggests that the second round of getting a wife is, let's fix the mistakes from last time. We're going to dafka just pick pretty faces. And we usually read it as, he's hedonistic. He's a shallow person, all he cares about is looks. There's not a relationship with another human being. It's just she's an object. So he just wants a pretty face. So Malbim says it could be there's politics in that also, which is in a sense even, perhaps even more revolting. There's not only is he not just in a relationship with a person, she's just a, he's a, it's hard to know which is more revolting. They're just picking based on the pretty face, or just picking based on, that looking for a pretty face was itself a political decision to show my power is not based on my wife. I'll just pick, a trophy wife. And they pick whoever's pretty because my power is rested in me. That's why it's Dafka. That's why they're just looking everywhere. That's not the way you find a royal wedding, a royal match where you're trying to consolidate power, where the House of Windsor is going to make a shidduch with the Habsburgs. Right? That's a carefully designed shidduch in the classic sense, right? Which has, you're not just walking around the countryside looking for pretty girls. Walk around the countryside looking for pretty girls, that means he doesn't need the wife for political purposes, he just, that itself was a political statement. But at the same time, there could have been other ways of dealing with Vashti more successfully.
Wow, wouldn't she make such a legion, just disregard for his type and consolidate power, but I don't see how else
he could have dealt with it, yeah. Other than forcing her to come.
But how? Just
by bringing her with the guards? Yeah, he sent the guards. She said no. The guards had too much covet for her, apparently, to just seize her. Right, seize her and bring her. But I think you are right. I think you are right that I maybe overstated the case. In terms of Perek Beis, it's not clear they necessarily regret. Although he probably personally misses her. Right? He may have had, you're right, let's say it more precisely. He at that point, he may have had no, in the chess game of the politics between Ahasuerus and Vashti, he had no choice politically but to eliminate Vashti. But Lamasa, look what happened. His political ambitions forced him to kill his wife. Isn't that sad? Again, that speaks to, he lost control. And let's make this more personal. Very often, there's a line in the Perek Shishi of Avos, which the Brisa that comes of Mishnah's Avos is five Prakim, then you have the sixth Perek is Shana Chacham B'Lashon Mishnah, a Perek of Brisa's that are added on, appended to Avos. So it says there that Chorus al Haluchos is coming up in the laning soon. That it says that Dibris were engraved on Haluchos, but the Chorus is an unusual word. Charus, other ways to say engraved. So the Tanam Dari, I think Shulam Levi Darshan is Charus. I'll take a Charus al Cheres. The choice of that particular word to say engraved is because you could also be read as freedom. There's Cheres on Haluchos. There's freedom in Haluchos. What does that mean? That in the Luchos you find freedom. The true freedom is going to come from learning Torah. From learning Torah, from living Torah. So the question is, thing. There may be great spiritual value. There may be endless alam haba from Luchos. But freedom, why is it freedom? It's avdus. It may be a worthwhile avdus, but it's avdus. I have all these rules I have to keep. So I know it's for my own good, and I know ultimately Alam Haba, I'm going to appreciate the great gift. Fine, good, true. But why do you describe it as freedom? It seems like the wrong thing to say. It's good, but why is it free? So this was the Baal of Brisker Rav and other Baalei Machshava developed the idea that it really is, right, like the Psukim say elsewhere, we spoke of just the other week in the Ramban Shir, right? As we're Avdei Hashem rather than being Avdei Paro. We saw that Mrs. Sharon in Perek Beis develops the idea that Paro being Meshabedas is in a certain sense a paradigm for the Sahara throughout the ages being Meshabedas, personally. Right? And then Atzas Paro to get us too busy is the first eighth of the Sahara. Get you too busy so you can't think. So you can't grow. So you can't take stock and change course and tinker and refine yourself. So you always get Avodas Hashem allows us to be free of being Avdei Paro in the larger sense of being Avdei Tzahara. And sometimes a person feels, for example, I'm so restricted, I can't do this, I can't do that. Right? I'll pick up a cigarette, I'll show them who's boss. Right? I'll smoke, I'll break the rules, I'll go into the roof, I'll have a few smokes with friends, whether I'm smoking tobacco or it's weed and rolling paper, whatever it is. And a person often feels he rebels, like now really free. That's sort of the message of Yetzirah, like now I'm freer. Or whatever I might be sniffing over there. But the truth is, when you're addicted, even psychologically addicted, you're not more free. You're actually less free. Just in ways we don't recognize. And the aside from everything else that the discipline of learning and living Torah does for us, not only does it give us Chai Olam Haba, and it gives us a deep sense of satisfaction in Olam Hazeh, it also trains us to actually really make our own decisions, as opposed to feeling meshubad to the psychological addictions that when the wants become needs. A life of Torah enables us to for the wants to be wants. And I can look at Amazon and say, here are things I can choose. Do I want to engage them or not? And sometimes I will, and sometimes I won't. There are times I'll eat more, there are times I'll eat less, and times I'll indulge in other parts of Amazon more or less. But I'm really, a life of the discipline of Torah Mitzvahs, it allows me to really have degrees of freedom in my life, to really be able to make decisions. Whereas, when I'm so cuffed to my desire for aspects of Olam Hazeh, that the wants become needs and I can't operate without them. That's something I enjoy and I can choose to engage or not engage. I no longer have my finger on the switch. I'm no longer in the driver's seat. I need this, I need that, I need this. I can't imagine living without it. Different aspects of Olam Hazeh, I haven't gained freedom. I've actually lost personal freedom. But that's exactly Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus thinks in his mind that he's in charge. And he's more in charge now. When in truth, we, looking from the outside perspective, look at him and say, we would laugh if it wasn't so sad. It's like tragicomic. He thinks he's so much more in charge. He's not in charge at all. He's the least in charge person. Vashti's more in charge. The Mumucha's more in charge. And exactly what you said, Yitz. Politically, he boxed himself in so much, he now needs to get rid of his wife. He can't even choose anymore. And it made sense within the political chess game. But he allowed himself to be put into a political chess game where in the end he lost freedom. That's sort of, the first part I think really stands on its own. That is a limud. Just to think about that. Again, for most of us it's in less dramatic ways. We usually don't try to play out our gaiva or our supposed sense of freedom, obviously with the same budget or the same drama as Achashverosh. Our personal dramas are usually less grandiose, but the Yesod is the same. To think about real freedom and real freedom in decision making. A bunch of guys are writing with questions. Are you writing? Then we'll work around the room. Yeah.
How is giving them, you know, how is that showing
acts of honor? Good question. How could it be? Seems ironic. It seems paradoxical, I should say. How could it be? You let everyone drink as they want, that shows absolute monarchy? The answer is, there is an element of populism that in this case is consolidating his power, because what he wants to do, the Malbim suggests, is to dissolve the power of the Tsarim. He's thinking politically, thinking in a Machiavellian fashion, if you will, and Achashverosh is trying to consolidate power. The way that's going to happen is not only an appeal to the people, it's not really an appeal to the people. That's a more modern idea, which could go well or poorly. But what he's doing is showing that the Tsarim are no one special. A, that's why he invites the Tsarim after his own personal retinue. And he wants to show that he has so much power that he can at will change, sounds like long-standing, for decades, maybe for centuries, Persian royal protocol. Because again, the stress there is, because that's what I said. And if I said it, you can ignore, you know, centuries of precedent. So that's why, ironically, paradoxically, giving people more power, but giving more power but on Achashverosh's terms, actually consolidates Achashverosh's power more. I don't think the Malbim makes the argument that he's trying to empower the populace in order to turn around and take the power from them. But definitely he's showing that he can break all the rules at will. Nothing is a sacred cow. Achashverosh is above the Tsarim, he's above the budget, Achashverosh is above precedent, Achashverosh rules all. Chanina.
Yeah, I didn't really catch the first part. You said real freedom on Al Mazah is not necessarily freedom. Rather, it's the opposite, really, there's more restriction. So you're saying that, and you're contrasting that to, can you clarify what you're...
Sure. When the Bryce in the sixth parak of Avos says, "Ein lecha ben chol misha osik b'Torah," right? Jashin from the pasuk, but the luchos, the true freedom is to be found within Torah. That sometimes strikes us as a funny idea. We might say goodness is found within Torah, and satisfaction al mazah and chayal al ma'aba. That we understand. But why do you call it freedom? It seems like, no, we're not free, but it's worth not being free. But why would you call it freedom? It's a good cause. It's a worthwhile trade-off. It's worth not being free and then shopping yourself to Torah in order to enjoy everything in Torah, the meaningfulness and the joy and grandeur. Great. But why call it free? So the saying is that what we often see as free, and any addiction counselor will tell you this, but again, addiction is just the most severe example of what's often true, again, in more mild ways, that a person's... when a person's wants become needs, there are things which we legitimately need, and there are things which we enjoy, and nothing wrong with enjoying.
And then you become such.
Right, when wants become needs, you end up becoming very shackled, and you lose flexibility and spontaneity, and you're not really able to make decisions. I can't handle this, I can't handle that, and right, I'm not really, I've lost degrees of freedom.
As opposed to...
Right, and to push us to take a step further, let's say the kid who starts smoking to show that he's really in charge. Right? Oh, my parents, my school, society, they think they're telling me what to do. No, I'll show them, I'll rebel. And then the puff and the cigarette, the drag of weed, now I'm really free. Now, there is a sense I'm free because I'm rebelling and breaking rules. But ironically, you usually end up less free. Because now I have a good friend who's a doctor. He said the way he deals with a population that where there's a lot of smoking. And he deals, a significant part of his practice is probably 20-30% of his practice at least, are pregnant women who are smoking a pack or two a day, which is terrible. He has pregnant women in his practice who drink alcohol on a regular basis, which is, it's mamish. It fetal alcohol syndrome is very real. And their unborn children will suffer for a lifetime because of their mistakes. And he had a hard time dealing something. It's a medical necessity to convince his people to give up the habit. And one of the things he does with smoking is just point out to them Like, think about how much this is costing you just in the wallet. Like, let's just sit down and crunch some numbers. How many packs do you smoke a day? How much does that cost you per day? How many days are there in a year? What would you do? It's like thousands of dollars. What would you, if I told you, right, you could have thousands of dollars extra a year, what would you do with that money? Right? Here's the way to do it. Just kick the habit. But it's so hard because you might have started this because you felt you're more free, but if you can't even choose to stop, if the want became a need, again, addiction is an extreme example of a want becoming a need, but any type of psychological addiction, you're not more free. There was an illusion of freedom that locked you into more avdus. A lifestyle of Torah mitzvahs actually gives you a greater ability over time to really make decisions, to make reasoned decisions, to really decide, do I want to engage this aspect of avdus or not? Maybe I will, maybe I won't. My rational mind will work together with my will to decide, what do I want to do? What makes the most sense to do? And I can really choose yes or no. That's real cheres. Real cheres, hedonism, locked into hedonism isn't real cheres. And that, and then bring it back here, that's Achashverosh. Achashverosh, in his gaiva, and the gaiva gave him the illusion that he's amassing power. When ironically, personally, he's actually shedding power. He's the least power. Everyone is controlling him because of the structure he set up for himself. Vashti controls him. The Muchen controls him. He ends up, ironically, politically impotent.
At a certain point, though, meaning there's only a range of flexibility that exists with the Torah lifestyle. Right? So there's flexibility to a degree. Like endless flexibility.
Right, but what it trains you to do, in other words, the fact that, let's take, that's a good question. I'm losing flexibility in the other end.
You can do X or Y, either way, you can't do Z.
Right.
But you really can only do
True. But here's the thing. Would a sane person say, I lack a certain degree of freedom because I'm not willing to run in the street when cars are coming? It's obviously silly. It's not a lack of freedom. I make a reasoned decision that I could run. A person could physically run to the street when cars are coming, but I make hopefully any reasonable person, any healthy person will make a reasoned decision. It's not something I will, of my own free will, choose to not run to the street because I want to maintain my life. Right? So that's not a lack of freedom. If a person is sitting on the sidewalk and he's handcuffed and he's shackled to the lamppost, then he taka can't cross the street if he wants to. It's not that he's making a reasoned decision. He has no choice. But if I stand at the corner and I say, you know what? I could run across the street, but I think it makes more sense for me to wait until the cars stop coming. That's not a lack of freedom. That's rational decision making. So as a Torah, as the combination of living Torah and learning Torah, now just following do's and don'ts, that understanding, so that will be, in a sense, blocking me in a certain way. Because I know I have to do this, I can't do that, but I don't want to see why. But to the extent that I marry mitzvah and meaning, I'm following the discipline of halacha, and I grow also over the years through my learning to appreciate more of why this is valuable, so then I'm like the guy at the corner. I don't lack freedom because I'm choosing to not do something. I am making a decision. Decision-making represents freedom. I will decide, this is what I want to do. I'm choosing to do mitzvahs because I understand that this is to my own long-term benefit. That is an expression of freedom. Unlike the guy who I want to become needs, and I don't really have the ability to choose otherwise. I think that's the key difference. Does my will answer to my mind? Does my will answer to my body? Who's working for whom? Any final questions?
Yes.
According to the Muslim, why not take it a step further? Why stop there? Why not just don't invite
Why not invite them at all? That would have been a bigger patch.
It's just listing them last on the list.
Yeah, Adirabba. If they don't get invited at all, it's a local party. It's a little strange they weren't invited. But it's not nearly as much of a statement as you're going to bring them there, and they're going to sit there, and they're going to watch how they lost all of their promise. And they're going to be just the same as that. Yeah, you can go drink like everyone else. You're going to rub shoulders with the hoi polloi. That's like the big, that's a far greater stuff. And it's a far more powerful political statement than not inviting them. And I would say politically also, if you don't invite them, you're setting up the possibility of while you're partying with your Shushan people, they're gonna create an alternative power structure. And you want them there. You want to keep your enemies close.
You want to keep your friends close and your enemies closer. You don't want them on their own doing their own thing, and you want them this, you could stick in their face, that of course you're part of the government, and so is that private and that corporal. And you're all the same. Yeah, I think it's Dr. Hanina.
I see, like, based on the answer to Ralph's question, I don't really see, what we're saying in terms of, really the obvious is freedom when it comes to Torah, it's actually freedom. I don't see, the argument as being, it's easy for us to say that this is really freedom because we're making rational decisions. But how is that any different than saying it's a worthy office? I don't understand how saying everyone's going to say that whatever they're doing is real freedom because they're making the right decisions. You could say that no matter where you are. So I don't see what we're saying more than basically just the classic what we're doing is freedom because really
it's worthwhile. You say, well, how will we progress beyond just saying it's not freedom, but it's okay because it's a worthwhile cost. How is this true freedom?
At the end of the day, we are doing things that we are not allowed to do certain things. We are only choosing.
Right. So I think that's where the redefinition comes in. In other words, freedom doesn't mean doing anything that comes to mind. Yeah, that's a mistake. In other words, just like, what's the best way to put it? A guy gets drunk. He's disinhibited, right? He lets go of the right alcohol even before, and as your blood alcohol rises slightly. You guys have all studied this, right, for the driving test. You will be studying for the driving test. Right? And blood alcohol is an extreme level, so then you begin to... It's not a question of losing your better judgment. It's a question of losing your ability to function at all. But a mild amount of alcohol, right? Enough that you shouldn't be driving, but not enough that you can't hold the steering wheel. If you could hold the steering wheel, that's actually, from a driving perspective, safer, because then the guy's not even going to be able to go anywhere. It may be more dangerous in terms of your personal health. But from a driving perspective, what's most dangerous is the guy is still able to function, sort of, but lost better judgment. Right? He's disinhibited. He's going to get up on the wheel of the car, and he can still press the gas and the brakes, and use the steering wheel, but he's not sharp, his reaction time is dulled, and he's not making good judgments. And Rachmanel, it's one of those bad judgments could be fatal to himself or to other people. Because he thought he could get across in time before that pedestrian gets across, and Rachmanel hits someone. Right? So the person is disinhibited, so in a sense he's freer. He has no inhibitions. He'll do anything. He'll say anything. But would you say that a person who's buzzed, has had a couple of drinks, is buzzed, he's more free than otherwise? Is he really more free? He's not inhibited. He's not limited in any way. But he's not. In the larger perspective, he's not free to make better decisions. What's the purpose of the freedom? In other words, to the extent, now, a person with a different value system, but who's acting rational, but who's really making decisions, he might have chayrus as well. Someone who's not kafuf to his desires, but has a different value system. He might also experience chayrus. Unfortunately, his value system is askew. He might use his chayrus for unfortunate purposes and unfortunate goals. He might use his freedom to make decisions to end up in places that he'll look back and regret. But he does have real freedom. But a person who's hedonistic, he may have the illusion of freedom, but in fact has less freedom because he doesn't have the ability to choose. When wants become needs, you don't really have... You've lost a degree of freedom because you couldn't really choose either way. A person who's living a life of Torah mitzvahs, and a life of meaningful Torah mitzvahs, in other words, doing what he's supposed to be doing and growing and learning and coming to understand more of the meaningfulness of it, see, he's really making decisions. Any rational person will make decisions and will sometimes incur costs in order to get other benefits. But the question is, do I have the ability to, I can really choose A or B, I'm deciding A versus B, or did I lost the ability to really choose B? That's real freedom.
Real freedom is not when I ignore the costs associated with my choices. That's insanity. Real freedom is where I recognize I could do A, I could do B. Each one has costs and benefits. And I have a value system that enables by which I make that choice. I really could choose either one, and I choose rationally this one or that one. I think that's the key. I think that's the key. Okay, we're going to... There's more.